Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Chris Evans here. A big thank you for downloading our Virgin Radio podcast. Coming up on this week's edition of the Best of the Breakfast Show with Sky, legendary Olympian Sir Chris Hoy chats cars in his new show, Dream Jobs with Chris Hoy. Fresh from starring in 1917, George McKay discusses his latest film, True History of the Kelly Gang. Paul Merton shares all about his West End debut, being married to Michael Ball in Hairspray. And the legendary Sir Bob Geldof tells us about his new album and book, plus Prue Leith and so much more. All on the way.
Not content with being one of the most decorated Olympic cyclists in history, he's turned his attention to four-wheeled friends. His new show, Dream Jobs with Chris Hoy, is available from tomorrow on the Motor Trend app. And here to tell us all about it is a man whose thighs precede him. It's Sir Chris Hoy!
Okay, I spy with my massive thigh. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Very well, too.
Excellent.
So we watched and enjoyed, as part of our half-term entertainment, the first of your shows yesterday, Dream Jobs with Chris Hoy. It's all about driving. So the first one is you and World Rallycross. All right, where does it begin? I know all this, and where does it end? How did you do? How did you find it all?
Yeah, well, basically, each episode, I shadow a person who has a dream job in motorsport. So in the first episode, it's World Rallycross. I met Ollie Bennett, who is a British World Rallycross driver. I went into Pembrey, and I had a shot of a 600 horsepower Fiesta rally car. And, you know, I basically had a day to get used to it and then went across to Barcelona, straight in the deep end, the World Rally Championship, World Rally Cross Championship, and I'm racing against the best guys in the world. And it was utterly terrifying.
It was. You could tell it was terrifying as well. It's really gripping. And so you're at Pembrey, and you do pretty well at Pembrey. You're just a couple of tenths off Ollie's time, aren't you?
Yeah, it was. So Ollie, you know, introduced me to the car, how to drive it, the specific skills. So for those who don't know, rallycross is it's a combination of tarmac and gravel. And it's a very short lap, and you race for about 2.5 minutes.
It's actually the most fun motorsport to watch. It's like real life scale X-Trick.
It is. If you speak to any racing driver and you say to them, what would you fancy having a go at outside of your form of motorsport, rallycross is always up there.
Yeah, I think it's quite big already. I think one day it will be massive.
It's absolutely huge. It's very spectator friendly. At the race in Barcelona, you can sit in the stand and you can see the whole race. You can see it from start to finish. There's a huge build up, the tension. There's no hanging around, and it's just, you know, from a driver's perspective, it's one of the most exciting things I've ever done.
And the Joker lap's quite handy and intriguing, clever.
Yeah, so because it's quite tight and it's quite hard to overtake, you have a Joker lap, and that's essentially one lap out of the four that you choose. You have to do a longer section.
So it's an extended bend, isn't it?
An extended bend, and you lose a bit of time. It takes probably about 4 seconds extra to go around this extension. And you can do it, if you're at the front, you would do that as late as possible. So you're going to try and have clear air in front of you to push on. If you're stuck in a queue, you would take the Joker early and then have some clear space to try and make up some time.
It's almost like an espresso pit stop. Not that you stop, but you can undertake an overtake via this thing.
Yes,
can't
that's
you?
Exactly. So that's your biggest chance to overtake. The start is crucial. You're lining up like six abreast. You know, you're holding this big hydraulic handbrake. You've got the engine 600 horsepower bouncing off the limiter. You're watching the lights and you've got to release the handbrake, drop the clutch, balance it just right and get it spot on. And I, without spoiling the story too much, in one of the races, I didn't have a particularly good start. And if you stall, then you have to do an extra Joker lap. Yeah. So it's just, it's incredibly tense. It's the most nervous, without exaggeration,
I know.
I've been since London 2012.
I could tell. Oh, maybe as nervous, actually.
Yeah.
I don't know, but maybe as nervous. Because you knew you had it in the tank with London 2012.
And at least you know what you're doing. You know, the whole point of this is I'm sampling. You know, I've raced cars for 7 years now, but it's been mainly circuit racing. Mm. So it's a passion of mine. I absolutely love it. And I do have a little bit of experience, but you know, on the track and cycling, I've done it for 20 years. I trained 6 days a week, 30 hours a week for many, many years. So you are an expert at that. You know what you're doing and your brain doesn't have to think about all these things that you're not used to.
Whereas exactly. All you had to do is call up the hard drive. I mean, I say all you had to do, but you had a pretty decent hard drive. Whereas on this thing, there are lots of aspects, there are lots of variables in process in flow, and you, the motor programs aren't embedded in you, and so you have to focus on one thing, and we can only think about one thing at a time. Obviously, yep. often we think we can multitask, but we can't because we're binary and we can't do it. You think you can, but you're fooling yourself. So one thing, something becomes a motor program, then you do it automatically, but that's not you thinking about having to do it, and you can only think about one thing at one time. So if you forget to press the start button, for example, and then you remember that, then you suddenly forget to release the handbrake, and then you've not got your foot flat to the floor. And suddenly you're last.
I mean, you've described it perfectly there. And Steve Peters, who was our psychologist in the cycling team, that's what he used to describe to us about using your computer, you know, the automatic program that goes through the motion. You don't have to think about what you're doing, and you can use your brain power to focus on stuff, the strategy, the sort of important stuff, and the rest is done automatically.
And that's the training. And so when Michael Schumacher was at his peak, they used to call it extra capacity, but he didn't have extra capacity, he just had free space in which to work, because everything else was so honed, wasn't it?
Exactly. And you look at most racing drivers will take up their sport when they're 5, 6, 7 years of age through karting. So it becomes automatic. For me, I took up motorsport when I was 38, I think. So it's like learning a musical instrument in your 30s or a new language. Your brain, it doesn't learn the motor programs that you develop, the sort of... just that ability to learn a new skill is much harder when you get older. So
you're gonna have fun, but you're never gonna nail it, are you?
Exactly.
If you take up the guitar when you're 38, you're always gonna be in a dad band. You're never really gonna get to the top of the charts. Not really, I wouldn't.
That's true.
So, Chris, how do we get to watch your shows?
Well, you can stream it on Motor Trend. So there's a Motor Trend app that you can download. It's free for the first 2 weeks, and then a subscription after that. And there's all kinds of motoring channels on there, different shows, thousands of hours of 4 wheels and 2 wheels for all kinds of motoring interests.
So it's a bit like a podcast, but a video podcast, I suppose, isn't it? It's the same kind of thing. So you don't need a broadcaster, and you're making this content and you're putting it out there. It's a bit YouTubey, but you can. It's a subscription service in its own right.
That's right. Yeah, and as I say, there's so many different forms out there. So it's not just my show. There's hundreds of other ones to see too.
Chris, it's great to see you again.
Likewise.
On Fine Farm, the show's really good.
Thank you.
Dream Jobs with Chris Hoy, episode 1 of 6, available tomorrow on the Motor Trend app. There you go. The Motor Trend app. That was Sir Chris Hoy.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky on Virgin Radio.
His new movie, True History of the Kelly Gang, is out next Friday, and here to tell us all about the legendary Australian bushman Ned Kelly is the wonderful George McKay.
Morning, George.
Good morning.
You all right?
I'm really well, thank you.
Well,
how are you?
I'm very well. You're very welcome. We'll talk about your film in a bit. I promise, loads, actually. But first of all, tell us about the last 4 weeks in your life.
It's just been mad. It's been, a lot of kind of dotting about all over the place. It's been very exciting, you know, going to all these different events, these like awards, meeting all these people. It's been a lot, but it's been good.
And you've ticked a lot of events and parties and people and places and experiences off the bucket list, haven't you?
Yeah, definitely.
So Golden Globes, you went there?
Golden Globes, yeah, we went to Golden Globes.
Emmys?
No, I wasn't there for that. We were at the BAFTAs,
BAFTAs
as well.
To the BAFTAs. BAFTAs.
There's lots of Guild Awards as well in America, and then we were at the Oscars the other week.
Oh, we're just at the Oscars. Okay, tell us about that, please, if you don't mind.
That was just like, well, it's a lot of things. It's just, firstly, it's just amazing being in that room. You know, you're just. It's a wonderful celebration, but you're also just looking at all these people that you've grown up with and kind of, oh my God, that's them there. That's, you know, Scarlett Johansson. That's Brad Pitt. That's, you know, that's Tom Hanks. It's you seeing all these people and then we had, you know, it's a lovely celebration of all the year's films. And then there's like the parties afterwards and everything. So it was grand.
Can we talk about one particular party you were invited to? Can we do that? Are we allowed to do that?
Yeah. We wound up at the Jay-Z party.
Now you say you wound up there, right? So there's the end of the Academy Awards and then there's you winding up at the Jay-Z party. So obviously a bit more jam in that particular sandwich.
Yeah. Well, actually, I mean, that's maybe the sort of less kind of party aspect. My parents are in town wonderfully, but you know, they're tricky. You need plus ones with all of this stuff, and unfortunately they couldn't get in, so I just spent most of the evening with my parents there. We went off, had a drink ourselves, and then when they went to bed things were still going on, so we thought we'd go out. that was, you know, and as I don't know, it sounds ridiculous, doesn't it?
So
we just popped along to
Jay-Z's. No, it sounds great. So did you try and expedite the process of your mum and dad going to bed without them knowing?
No,
it's getting a bit late, mum. Yeah, you look a bit tired.
I think it's just that Well, just everything. I'm a bit of an old man usually. Like, I'd probably be in bed before them usually. Right. But then, you know, the night being the night, you think, no, we've got to juice this. We've got to stay out, go out. And so, you know, they went off at a pretty late hour as well. But I think things are going on all through the night. So.
I think so. Well, I know so. But I wasn't sure, because I'm stupid, I wasn't sure whether Ned Kelly was a fictional character or not. But he definitely existed.
Yeah, he definitely existed. But I guess that's what the film's about, in terms of, like, he existed. But now, it's at least in Australia, his name and his image kind of this bulletproof helmet, homemade helmet, has been appropriated to kind of mean anything by lots of other people, but no one actually knows who he really, like, I'm sure, like, there's lots of history, like, historical kind of
lots of
text
legend
on it,
though, lots of myth,
but sort of, like, he's become almost part of fiction. He's a symbol that people appropriate rather than the man himself, and this is a film about a kind of version of that man trying to put down his own history.
But the first 20 minutes of Ned as a boy, played by a brilliant young actor. Who's that?
Orlando. Orlando's amazing. Orlando Schwartz.
Okay, so and that sets up his backstory and the trauma and the rage deep within, which turns him into the kind of fearless anti-hero that he becomes, I suppose. His mum, who he absolutely idolises because his dad is basically rubbish, then goes and sells him.
Yeah.
To this vagabond.
Yeah.
And he thinks that this guy is a gentleman who's come to sort of save him and say, you know, life can be like this, but he doesn't realise he's secretly been sold by his mum to become Russell Crowe's character's very reluctant, murderous 11-year-old assistant or 12-year-old assistant.
Yeah, he's a confused young man.
Just a bit.
He's pulled from pillar to post, and, yeah, his understanding of the world keeps chopping and changing in the most extreme ways. And I think, yeah, the man that you meet, like, when I play him as an adult, he's just caught in the maelstrom of all of that confusion, having been kind of believed one thing and then having that ripped away from him and then going, but kind of being drawn back to the thing that threw him that direction. It's just, and so then as an adult, he's trying to kind of suss that out for himself and take ownership over all of that stuff.
Mm. And the first time we see you is under a Union flag. Mm. And I'm thinking, hang on, I've got the wrong movie here. It looks like, I don't know, it looks like Quadrophenia 2 or something. And you look a bit like Bradley Wiggins in it, across between Bradley Wiggins and Paul Weller. And it's all a bit punky. And that's all on purpose, isn't it?
Yeah, completely. Like, just the thing is, Ned Kelly in Australia, like, is such a revered figure that people are terrified of touching that history. And so stories about him are sometimes kind of a bit bound up by that.
Yep.
And Justin said, we're going to let go of the history and we're going to make it in the spirit of these boys rather than, you know, by the letter of what has been said, especially if what we're trying to say is, who knows if what was said was right. So, yeah, he said, I see the Kelly Gang as a punk band. And for that, in rehearsals, he got us to form a punk band.
I heard about this.
Yeah, we turned up 4 weeks before shooting and he was like, right, so I see him as a punk band. So I booked you boys a gig in Melbourne and you're going to form a band, write some songs and play a gig. And we did. And he's like, I want you listening
to
each
other. What a great way to prepare you for a role.
It was mad. It was mad. And it got us listening to each other, like, differently and opening up because you're sharing songs.
You've got, of course.
Like, first day, you're like, well, I've written this poem as the character. How's that? And then you you do the gig, and we did it in dresses in a bar and, like, just under a different name and everything. So it was a kind
in
of anonymous.
In dresses in a bar.
You know, an anonymous gig. But then the next day, you walk on with this swagger of being like, we did that, whatever. Like, yeah. We can do anything, which is this attitude of the guys.
And what the director got you, what he achieved was, which is what he wanted to achieve, is he got you thinking as one.
You're
a unit, weren't you then?
Yeah.
And that's the really clever move. George, it's great to see you. True History of the Kelly Gang, released next Friday, nationwide.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky on Virgin Radio.
From co-founding the Comedy Store Players to the long-running brilliance of Have I Got News For You, our next guest really knows what he's doing. He'll soon be making his West End debut alongside big voices and even bigger hairdos in the hit musical Hairspray. Please welcome the wit and the wonder of the one and only Paul Merton.
Good morning, Paul. Oh,
good morning.
So first of all, welcome to the doctor's surgery. What's going on with the voice and the throat?
Yesterday I didn't have much of a voice. I just come back from holiday and I think change of temperature. I just come back from Cuba, which was fantastic. But of course, you know, Cuba, it's very, very hot. And here I understand you've had a lot of storms over the last couple of weeks.
Yep.
So yesterday I didn't have much of a voice. And I appreciate the irony of coming on and talk to you about my musical West End debut with no voice at all. But thankfully it's back.
OK, but you have time because it's not till the 21st. 23rd of April.
Yeah, 2 months away, yeah.
All right, so Paul Merton in Hairspray. Okay, why not, of course, but why?
Well, they asked me, which was rather surprised, and I'd seen the show before, and it's a very good feel-good musical. And the part I'm playing is, I'm married to Michael Ball. We have a song together. I don't have a great deal of many, and there's not a huge number of lines, but it's a bit of a challenge. But then, of course, I do, TV sitting on panel shows and stuff, but generally I do work as a performer most of the time, stage performer. So it's challenging, but I don't think it's beyond me. We'll soon find out, of course.
So how is the singing?
Well, I think I might be able to busk the singing, as it were, but the dancing's going to be a problem. When I played Widow Twankey in the Wimbledon pantomime a couple of years ago, the choreographer was convinced that everybody can dance. And after about 2-3 weeks, he said to me, "I see your eyes glaze over." Not only could I not figure out what I was meant to do, I couldn't figure out when I was meant to do it. So we just sort of, I said, we'll just walk around to the music.
Right, so Widow Twankey, not a million miles away from you inhabiting this part in Hairspray. How long did you play Widow Twankey for? How did it go? The highs and lows of being a pantomime dame.
Oh, well, yes. I mean, it's pantomime is one of the great British traditions. The part of Widow Twankey was first invented in 1860, so it goes back a long way. An English comic who was the most famous English comic of his day, a guy called Dan Leno, played Widow Twankey in Drury Lane. No, it was great. It was two shows a day for about a month. Myself and Pete Furman was in it, and Lee Ryan was in it. We had a few other people. It's great because you're given the ability to improvise in a pantomime. You're allowed to do it. So in the early days of the run, when the rest of the cast weren't too sure about their lines and they got something wrong, they'd say to me afterwards, "Oh, I'm sorry." I said, no, I said, "That's gold dust for me. I can spin off that," and it's great. I mean, one day Lee Ryan, instead of calling the Empress "Your Highness," called her "Your Honour," and I just stepped forward and said, "He's got a court case tomorrow," and just things like that. And so it was a great joy, but also there's a great responsibility in something like that, because you're allowed to play around, but also there are dramatic parts within it, because I am Aladdin's mother, so I have to be concerned when Aladdin's missing. But there was one bit, we had school shows, where it's just the pupils in, and somebody said to me, "The noise is unbelievable. But apparently it's louder than a jumbo jet." So the point when Abenaza comes on disguise and tries to get the magic lamp off me, and I don't know it's him, and I'm offering the lamp, and the kids are shouting "No!" and they're screaming, I couldn't hear what Abenaza was saying, even though he was standing to me as close as you are, and he's mic'd up. I could see his lips moving, so I knew what the lines were, but the scream, it was just extraordinary.
The Beatles Shea Stadium.
Yeah, it was like that. It was like that.
That's why they gave up playing, wasn't it, the Beatles?
They couldn't they couldn't hear themselves.
Yeah, there's no point.
And John Lennon said, something like, the speaker's the size of a peanut. Yeah, so, they couldn't hear each other. And so they started, they realised they weren't improving they sort of started that whole business of a band being able to play to 20,000, 50,000 people.
Yeah. Didn't they accelerate the development in technology for amplification because they had to, apparently?
I think they were, the first time they played Shea Stadium, I think they were coming out through the announcer's
PA. Unbelievable. Right, I don't know the plot of Hairspray. I've got it written down here, yes. But you do, so you tell us about it.
Well, I have seen the production about 10 years ago, so I'm going from the memory of that. And I took it on holiday and I've read it. It's about, really, it's a 16-year-old, 15-year-old girl who's desired to appear on this talent show on American TV, who wants to make the world a better place. And it's about a sort of the unification between black and white culture. It's a very feel-good thing, and I think sort of in this day and age as well, when we have the example of Greta Thunberg, who's a 16-year-old who wants to make the world a better place, it has a sort of resonance for today. It's one of those musicals where you come out really feeling really upbeat and really fantastic.
See, now I just want to go and see it straight away. So you're doing the job that...
It is. I mean, I'm a good fan of musicals. One of the first things I saw many years ago was Michael Crawford in a thing called Billy that was based on Billy Liar, the book. And I was at Drury Lane, and I went to see that 2 or 3 times. And I just... when you go to see a good stage musical, you get transported somewhere else.
You do. You transcend. I went to see The Producers 8 times, and I ended up crying at the overture. Whatever the opposite of the overture is at the end, when the medley, whatever it is, and I was just, there were tears of joy.
Yeah,
I wasn't like laughing or I was just literally, I was broken for all the right reasons as opposed to all the wrong reasons.
Yeah, well, when it's done right, it just takes you somewhere.
What is that about? Do you think
it's the power of music, isn't it? It's the power of music, the power of live performance, particularly in this day and age when a lot of us carry around sort of portable screens and stuff. To see it actually happening in front of you, and we're on at the Coliseum, which I think is the biggest auditorium in London, 2,500 people. people, something like that. So if you get 2,500 people into something, then the whole experience of just being in the audience is transforming.
We heard this last week, and we think it's true, so from a scientific point of view, that when you laugh, it's the only time your fight and flight system turns itself off, and it turns off completely when you laugh, and then it turns itself back on immediately. Have you heard that before?
I mean, no, I haven't heard that. But I mean, certainly when you're laughing at something, when you're really seeing something funny, your brain is flooded with these good feel chemicals, which are naturally produced by the body. Nothing else exists for you at that moment. You don't have no mortgage worries. You don't worry about the kids' education. For that moment, when you're laughing at something, you are completely consumed by that laughter. So I can well believe what you're saying is true.
Give us a couple of most memorable Comedy Store players' nights.
Oh, well, it's...
Robin Williams or anyone like that
He popped in. Yes, he popped in one day, a long time ago now. I mean, I can't remember actually any bits that we do, because the thing about improvisation is it goes out of your mind as soon as you've done it. Right. So somebody comes up to you afterwards or the following week and says, oh, I love that bit about the budgie with a Geordie accent that played rugby for Halifax. And you say, what? And it turns out it was a 10-minute scene or whatever. But it's funny how the brain works, because your brain knows about you actually having to send it a message. You don't need to remember that anymore. It's not important. It's gone.
Right, so when do you sit down with Michael Ball for the second time about... what's it... I mean, you know, as far as wife material is concerned...
Yes.
What do you think of Michael Ball? As you know,
I think he's a very attractive woman.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky on Virgin Radio.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We've heard from three guests already, but there's loads more still to come. Prulith chats her brand new cookbook, The Vegetarian Kitchen. Sir Bob Geldof tells us about his brand new book, Tales of Boomtown Glory, an album, Citizens of Boomtown. Author extraordinaire Giovanna Fletcher telling us about her new book, Letters on Motherhood, and what it was like having the Duchess of Cambridge star on her Happy Mum, Happy Baby podcast. All that and more, but first, Dapper Dave, who's next?
The new book, Tales of Boomtown, and new album, Citizens of Boomtown, are both out next month and here to tell us more.
No, you're wrong.
Is
no, you're wrong.
Toe.
You got the name wrong.
What's the name?
Evans. This show has gone pear-shaped already. Tales of Boomtown Glory.
I don't write the intros. I've got some amazing questions for the interview.
Okay.
All right.
The new book, Tales of Boomtown Glory, a new album, Dave, Citizens of Boomtown.
Dave, can you imagine working with him for 2.5 years? Absolute nightmare. Made him a fortune.
Okay, here we go.
Did.
The new book, Tales of Boomtown Glory, and new album, Citizens of Boomtown, are both out next month. And here to tell us more is a co-writer of one of the biggest selling singles of all time, a rock star, a knight of the realm, a charity founder, and a man with a real eye for detail. It is, of course, the one and only Sir Bob Geldof.
Good one, Dave. Yes. Yeah, eye, ear, pulse for detail. Really annoying, actually. But great to have you here, Bob.
Thanks, man.
Bob, I love your book, Tales of Boomtown Glory. You speak beautifully, but you write even better. You should write more, really. I mean, can you do me a favour? Can you read out those two paragraphs from your own book, if you don't mind?
Is that the bit with the cursing or no?
No.
Oh, dear. No.
Then circle. It's about songwriting. Off you go.
Yeah. For sure, there are lines in rock that are as incandescent as anything written by the poetic greats, but they're just that, a few lines. The complete song, however, may ultimately leave you as moved as the greatest poem. It is not a lesser form. Leonard Cohen is an okay poet, but a great lyricist. Bob Dylan's earlier songs are awful poetry, but superb lyrics with poetic sounding imagery. Pop doesn't have to make sense. It just has to feel sense. It inhabits an emotional intelligence rather than a rational or intellectual or empirical one. Lyrics don't have to be about anything, a truth or an apparent truth that can be beyond actual meaning. Coherence is not required. What is required of a song lyric is an idea that fits around the music or vice versa, rather than any metaphoric or practical reasoning. And therein lies the difference between the poet and the lyricist. It's the tune, stupid.
What a lovely way to describe it. I had no idea. What a great insight from a musician and a lyricist into what he does for a living and the difference between a lyricist, a great lyricist and a great poet. You can, of course, be both, Bob.
You can, but I've never heard it take a great poet, the great Irish poet who's my master, you know, I never tried to copy him, or one can't, but just simply he's just too good. The Waterboys put a whole album of his songs to music. Van Morrison's Crazy Jane on God. Van is always referring to Yeats, and that a lot of the Irish bands, the lads are nodding their head, constantly refer to his use of language. And he called his own poems lyrics. But when you put his words to music, a famous Irish traditional song is Down by the Sally Gardens, which originally was a Yeats poem, they're pretty crap. It doesn't really work because the poet can sum up. He's only got words and meter and scansion to say what he needs to say, whereas the subtext of pop songs are the underlying music, the rhythm, the melody, the note selection, the solo choice, the meter, the scansion, the rhythm. All of that lies under just what appears to be a simple lyric, and so it carries you forward into the emotional universe it wants to take you into. Now, it's a bit early in the morning for this sort of stuff, as the world switches. Oh dear, what's on the other channel?
Our listeners have all this. Of course they do. But the thing you do have in common, all artists have in common, is they want to get something from inside out.
Yeah.
And you did that, you know, during your first job in the abattoir. You were writing things down, you're writing your feelings down. What is it about an artist that makes them, apart from sort of, you know, I don't know, self-soothing, if you like, but what is it that makes artists want to get things out?
In the case of the abattoir, I was working, it was a slaughterhouse of dreams rather than an abattoir for animals. The people working in there were hopeless and had nowhere else to go. They were as trapped as the animals that we were killing. And I mean, for me, I was a kid. I knew there was something else. I wasn't sure what. I knew I had to go and chase it and find it, and I needed some cash. I didn't know I was writing our first number one, the first Irish number one ever, or the first New Wave number one. I didn't understand that. I didn't think I was writing a song. I was just writing a story about the people that were around me. To what end, I'd no idea. So when the second Rats album, A Tonic for the Troops, was coming to an end, the producer, Mutt Lange, who went on to do AC/DC and, you know, Shania Twain and The Cars and everybody, Muse, all those people, and he was a young kid too, he said, we're missing the track. Codeline will understand that you're doing an album, but there's something that's not complete about this work, sort of thing. And I said, I don't have anything. He said, you must have something. So, a long story short, I said, I've got this thing that I just had years ago, and there's something about it. He said, okay, read it to me. So I read it, and he said, have you got any music to it? And I just played, dang, 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 just playing the guitar, G, D, E minor, damn, bam, bam, just do that. G, D, E minor, damn, damn, damn. That's it. And so I said, I'm just doing that. And that became bam, 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 da, 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 bam, bam, bam. He said, that's good. Where does that go? And he just pulled like a loose thread on a cardigan, this thing that was bugging me for a few years now, since I started the abattoir. What is it? What is it? And he pulled it out to me. And that was the complete album. And it also, bizarrely, we went on the Kenny Everett show, and Kenny said, will you do that track? I said, yeah. And the next day, people went to record stores, when there were record stores, like in a movie, and asked for the song they heard. And it took us, get this, guys, 680,000 sales to get to number one. Wow. That 680,000 people had to save their pocket money, walk down to a record shop
and ask for it.
Ask for it, and they had to have it and look around at all the records and what everybody else just to get there. But we did kill Olivia Newton-John and John Travolta. Yes!
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky on Virgin Radio.
She's a legend in the kitchen, an OBE and CBE, a bake-off superstar, and her brand new cookbook, The Vegetarian Kitchen, is out now. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the very recent octogenarian with tips and tricks for the vegetarian. It is, of course, the one and only Prue Leith.
Very good. Very nice, David. Well done. Good morning, Prue. Welcome. Good
morning, Chris. I'll tell you one thing. I don't think these guys are looking for octogenarian fans, but they've got one.
Oh, good. By the way, I didn't know you were 80 years old.
80 years old.
She doesn't like 80, does she?
No,
you look 60 for day.
No, I'm in scarpering off in the loo to put my lippy on. So,
well, can I have some, please? Because if that's all it takes, you know, you do look so well. And even though the last time I saw you, you were wheelchair bound, you even look well there in a field in Hampshire. So, what was wrong with your leg? How's your leg now?
My leg's fine now. What had happened is that I bust my Achilles tendon, dressed up in a lion suit, jumping on the Bake Off set.
Well, that's your own fault then, in that case.
Yeah. Well, it's not, actually. It's Channel 4's. I should sue them.
Could you?
Don't be silly.
Should you? Would you?
Don't be silly.
So how is it now? You say it's better, but you're still pretending now and again it's worse than it is because...
Well, because then you get people to carry your bags,
perfect,
and you can
perfect.
Go in taxis instead of walk, and it's all that's all good things.
So the vegetarian kitchen, how up were you with vegetarian cooking before this cookbook with your niece Peter? I called her Petter before, sorry.
Peter. I was quite keen on vegetarian cooking for years and years and years. In fact, when I had my famous Michelin star restaurant, we had a separate vegetarian restaurant menu from the normal one, because I always thought vegetarians don't like to see their options in between the sort of veal liver and the suckling pig, you know. So we had separate menus.
Yeah, because they don't even want to read meat, let alone eat meat.
Yes, exactly. And then I wrote a vegetarian book 25 years ago, but my publishers wouldn't let me. They said, if you have the word vegetarian in the title, you won't sell a single copy.
Right.
And that was true in those days. I mean, the vegetarians were thought of as sort of cranks and crazies, and you know, chefs didn't like them, and often, I don't say they'd spit in their food, but they didn't like them a lot.
Metaphorically speaking, let's hope.
yes, maybe. But anyway, now it's completely changed, and my niece is vegetarian. And I thought it'd be good to have a carnivore write a vegetarian book with a real vegetarian.
Yeah,
because I don't want to be preachy about it. I'm not going to give up the odd, you know, slice of liver or sweetbreads or all this stuff.
Well, it's so important because, you know, otherwise you're preaching to the converted, and you don't want to preach at all, but also a sort of soft version of that is you don't want to live in an echo chamber, you know, and there's a lot of fun to be had here. There's a lot of freshness to be had. Also, when, you know, I didn't eat meat last night, went to Tom's place, the coach, and I went for all the non-meat options. And this one, I do feel lighter, I do feel different. I still love my meat, don't get me wrong, and I'll have some this weekend. But, you know, it's horses for courses, but it's always all right to wander into somebody else's field now and again.
Yeah, it is, and it's good fun. And I think that what people don't realise about veg cooking is that it can have just as much richness and depth and flavour as, you know, steak and kidney pie.
Yeah.
You know, I've been to two schools now where the entire meals are vegetarian.
Really? One is
a secondary school in Sheffield, and they do have fish dishes on Friday because they think that fish is good for the brain, which it is, you know, because of all the omega-3 oils. But all the children eat vegetarian, and they are fantastic. The day I was there, they were having tacos with sort of some little spicy fillings and some sort of pepperoni-type fillings. And I mean, it was just delicious, and the children were gobbling it up.
Right. How did they get that to happen in those schools? Because I know, because we get a lot of correspondence from parents, pupils, and teachers and people involved in schools saying, how can we get our school to become more healthier?
Well, I think the trick is that the head teacher, first of all, has to absolutely believe in it. So he leads, or she leads the charge. And she gets all the parents together and she talks to them and she says, look, if we can train your children to eat well, they will live longer, they'll have a happier life, they'll be healthier, and it'll be cheaper.
Yeah.
And it'll be better for the planet. And, you know, parents aren't stupid. If they think, if somebody else can wave this magic wand and change my children from wanting nothing but chips and chocolate, why wouldn't they say yes?
I know.
And then they do say yes, and then they say, well, okay, the first thing is the children mustn't bring food into school. Because if you've got a lunchbox which is full of, you know, chips and cake or whatever, you're not going to eat lunch.
Yeah.
So they have to eat lunch. It's part of the deal. And, of course, they have a different lunch every day, so they get to change, they get to taste different things. And they're hungry when they get to lunch, or just a little bit, pleasantly hungry. Yeah, yeah. So they will try new things.
And better food fills you up more sort of satisfiedly than food that has the same amount of calories in, but not the same nutrients. You do not feel as full, so you want more of bad food than you do of good food.
Is that true?
Which is really important.
No, I'm not surprised. There is something about, you know, real junk that you just go on eating it, you know, if you've...
Also, junk. You can eat junk food quickly with your hands. You don't chew it as quick because obviously it's processed. Often it's processed on purpose, and then so it doesn't mix with your saliva. And if it doesn't mix with your saliva, it doesn't fire your leptins up. And if you don't get your leptins fired up, the leptin is the chemical that makes you feel full, and that's why you don't feel full and you eat more of it and you get fat before you know it.
So why didn't I ask you to write the intro to our book?
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky on Virgin Radio.
She's a children's TV star, an Instagram sensation, a Sunday Times best-selling author and podcasting royalty in more ways than one. Her 10th book, Letters on Motherhood, is out on Thursday, and here to tell us all about it is the parenting professor herself, Giovanna Fletcher.
All right, and a reprise of the cheer for who it was meant for, not for me. How are you, Giovanna?
I'm very good, thank you.
You
very
good. Smiling ear to ear, as always, but particularly after the weekend that you've experienced. So... the Duchess of Cambridge was on your podcast. It's in its third series, 56th episode and counting. Well done, congratulations. Happy mum, happy baby. Here's just some of what she had to say.
If you could write a letter to anyone about motherhood, who would it be to and what would you say?
That is a very interesting question.
I like to put people on the spot.
I know. Mm. Can I write back to myself? Is that really weird?
You definitely can.
I think I'd like to have written to myself at the beginning of my pregnancy with my first child, because I think what I've experienced not only as a mother, but also what I've learned on my sort of journey through digging deeper into the early years landscape, I've learned a huge amount that I would really love to go back and really sort of tell myself at the beginning of pregnancy, right at the start, what things I feel now really matter in terms of being a parent, but also what really matters to the children and my children now.
Very profound answer to a great question, Giovanna. Well done on, you know... everything, tick, gold star, top of the class and all that. How did you get her on the show?
Well, I've been writing letters since the podcast launched. So we're now in the fifth series. And from day one, whenever I was doing press, it's that obvious thing that always gets asked, who's your dream guest? The Duchess of Cambridge, because she's the most talked about mum, but we never actually hear from her. So I started sending emails. They fell on deaf ears. They weren't read. And then literally because of the work that she's doing in early years this year, and there's this massive push with her five big questions, and there's a massive survey that's going out until the end of this week, I think, it kind of married in. So I was invited to Kensington Palace last year. I came away. And actually, in that chat, I was told I would get... possibly 10 minutes with her, possibly, but they couldn't guarantee it. And then we met and it turned into 45 minutes, and then we were in the room and it turned into an hour and a half. And I literally cannot believe that it's happened. But she is just wonderful. Literally so wonderful.
This is like your equivalent of winning The Apprentice but not being able to tell anyone until it's aired. So you obviously, the more you said about this potentially happening, the less chance there would be of it coming to pass. So you've got to sit on your hands, you've got to bite your tongue.
And it happened on my birthday. We recorded it on my birthday.
Oh, see.
Yeah.
But well done. Congratulations. So what is... It's now the number one... This podcast is currently the number one podcast in the world on iTunes. So what's the last few days been like?
It's been really weird. It's been bonkers. I think the week before, I couldn't sleep. Literally, I just thought, I've wanted this for so long and now it's happening. And there seems to be a lot of pressure that comes with it. And, you know, what is she going to say? How am I going to feel when that's kind of taken out of context, or if it is? And then I thought, you know what? She's a mum. And just do exactly what you normally do for every other episode. And actually, when I started planning the episode, that's when it all fell into place. And just before we walked into the room, actually, to do the recording, we were at a royal engagement in a nursery in Stockwell. And we'd been sat playing with these this group of children. And one of them had had said to us, "Oh, my name's Peppa. My name's Peppa." And we were like, "Okay, hello, Peppa." She's like, "And this is my friend George." And at that point, it did not twig at all what she was doing. And as we walked away, she turned to the Duchess and she said, "And you're Daddy Pig. Bye, Daddy Pig." And then she turned to me, "Bye, Mummy Pig." So this little four-year-old, we were laughing. She kind of broke the ice. So we were laughing as we left that room and into the other room to do the recording. So that kind of kept us at ease. I think, because we were both nervous. And at the top of the podcast, we say we are nervous because we both knew what that was that we were doing and that it was going to be picked up and the first time that she's ever spoken about motherhood. Like any of these things, these people come into a studio and you think they've just been plonked in and they don't know anything about what they're about to do or what they've signed up for. Someone else has thought it's a great idea. But to know that she'd actually listened to the podcast, she got what it was about and that we are trying to take the judgment out of parenting and realise that it doesn't matter who you are, what you have, what you do. There are so many things that unite us. And actually, if we don't talk about those things, about the fact that we find it hard sometimes, about the fact that it's overwhelming, then they can become so huge.
But anyway, you're here to talk about the book.
I know, it's such a funny thing. I'm in promo for the book this week, but obviously this massive thing has happened.
Well, it's all good news. And this book is absolutely fantastic. This is Letters to Your Unborn Children.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about those.
So when I first found out I was pregnant with Buzz, I'd actually had a miscarriage before that, and I was quite scared going into that pregnancy. And I just... so that I could get my thoughts down and to start connecting with him every night before bed, me and Tom were taking turns to write in this book, just telling the baby what we'd been up to, if there was movement, you know, whether they'd had their first kicks, how big I was feeling, anything like that. And at the time, McFly had playing the Albert Hall, like things were going well with my career. So there's loads of stuff in there that's kind of that time. And it's something that we kept doing for each child, although poor Max, and Max is the third baby. And I think by the time you're three children in, when you get to bed at night, you're so shattered. So he's probably got far less than the other two.
Sunny today, telly on the blink. That's it. We'll update you when you're born.
Yeah. I think if we ever go for a fourth, hopefully Buzz will be able to write by then. He'll just write the whole thing, you know.
So the nose turned into an if during our conversation.
You have been pushing it.
So this is off air, not on air.
I never say never.
Never
because
say
you
never.
Never know. But I think the shop is shut, but who knows?
For mums, dads, parents everywhere, and other people too, Letters on Motherhood, Giovanna Fletcher. And the podcast continues to rule the world. Her podcast, Happy Mum, Happy Baby. Thank you, Giovanna.
Thank you so much.
You're awesome.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky on Virgin Radio.
She's an author that once said she would never write a novel. Well, quite frankly, she was lying, because she's published loads of them, has sold over 30 million of them, and has been translated into 33 languages. Her new book, Grown Ups, is out now, and here to tell us all about it is a lady that really knows her prose. It's the brilliant Marion Keyes.
Thank you very much. Dapper Dave. Good morning, Marion.
Good morning, Chris.
Have you really been up since 4:20, and were you really feeling anxious about the show?
I've been awake since 4:20.
Right.
I didn't get up till about 6.
Okay.
Yeah, I am. I'm a combination of anxiety and excitement because it's you and it's early in the morning. And when I woke at 4:20, I was thinking I could take half a night on and try and get back to sleep. But then I thought I might be kind of dopey. Yeah. When I arrived. So no night all, no dopiness.
Okay, excellent. It's great to have you here.
I'm thrilled.
As Dapper Dave just said there, he said you sold over 30 million books. It's nearly 40 million. It's 39 million. This book will see the big 4-0. Not many people see that particular big 4-0 in their lives. Are you good at anything else? Because you're brilliant at writing.
You're so nice. No, I'm good at almost nothing else.
Right.
I started painting pictures last August and... I made the mistake of putting them on Twitter, on Instagram, and everyone is so lovely on Instagram that, you know, they tell you everything is lovely, even when it isn't. So I have mistakenly decided that actually I'm a fantastic painter and this is what I really should be doing.
But what if you are a fantastic painter? I've not seen it. Let's call some of these up. Let's have a look. All right, so grown-ups. I was reading the reviews at the weekend, almost by accident, to be honest, because I was away. I wasn't in work mode. We're off for 4 days. I'd forgotten he was scheduled to come on the show, not because I didn't care, because I think about where when I'm at work.
You're in downtime. Exactly. Of course, you deserve it.
And I was reading the reviews of all the books, which I do every weekend, looking at the book charts, because I'm fascinated by them. And the reviews for your book, they were just like off the charts.
I've never experienced anything like this, Chris. This is the first time really in 25 years that there has been this kind of across the board love, you know. And my dad died just over a year ago, and my mother is absolutely insistent that it has nothing to do with me, that it is Dad who is, you know, like puppet managing the whole thing from heaven, you know, that he's having a word with the right people. And quite seriously, she, I mean, maybe it is. How do I know? But either way, I'm really, really grateful.
Right. Well, listen, Hells Bells, who works on the show, has nearly finished this book. It's called Grown Ups, by the way, this novel. It's 600-odd pages. And it's funny from the get-go. Isn't it? It's just dialogue's hilarious. Have the film rights been picked up for this at all?
They haven't yet, but now that you mention it.
But it's so funny. If I was in the position where I could come up with dialogue like that, I'd forget about the plot. But you've got to get the... Because the plot keeps the car rolling along the road.
Things have to happen. Yeah. You're absolutely right. We can't keep having a conversation about Mr. Segway. Somebody has to fall in love with the wrong person or find out that they don't love their person anymore. You know, that has to happen.
If you were in a writer's room now, right?
Yes.
So people are on a retreat. They want to be taught by the best, and you are right up there with the best in the world.
Thank you.
You know, and you said, okay, something's got to happen to one of these wives, first of all, who's married to one of these three brothers.
Yeah.
What would be a killer thing to happen? What is a go-to thing to happen for a writer who's not really up to speed yet?
Well, infidelity always goes down well.
Right.
Yeah. No, it does. I mean, intrigue, you know. I mean, people doing things that they're not actually supposed to do.
Right. Supposed to in inverted commas.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. They're not fitting into the template
because
of what
society has written these rules somewhere in the ether that we've all somehow agreed to over the centuries.
Yes.
That may no longer hold true.
Yes, and that's exactly it. People love. I mean, I love to read about people who do terrible things or break the rules because it makes me feel better about all my flaws. So a spending addiction is always delicious as well, because I think a lot of people kind of relate to that. I mean, I do. Like, I go to bed at 10 o'clock every night to read a book, allegedly, but then I just get my tablet and I start scrolling on Zara and I'm still there like 2.5 hours later.
What is it with Zara? It's Zara on Monsoon, isn't it? It's Zara and who? Who else is it? Is it mostly Zara?
ASOS as well, maybe.
ASOS, of course, it's ASOS. These are the packages that arrive at our house every day, and Tasha's like, oh, they're for next door. No, they're not. They've got your name on them, for heaven's sake.
I am first best friends with the DPD man. Yep, my lovely George. Me and George are like so close because I see him more than I see my husband.
Yeah. And you write between 9 and 1 every day.
Yeah.
Okay, so it is a proper job, but it's a job you love. And because you give it those regular hours, that's why it's so detailed. That's why it's got such attention in it, because you can tell you've got the time in here to really sort of to really pare down a real crisp
line and
a crisp sentence. And, you know, there's no fat in this at all, is there? Even though it's 600 pages long, it still flies along.
You see, I'm lucky in that my publisher gives me the time to do it properly. Like, there was a time when I used to write a book a year, and I could when I was younger and had more energy and had more creativity. But now...
And more drive.
Yeah, it's true. I have less
because
drive
you've
now.
Well, you've written 18 books. Yeah. The drive has to sort of dissipate a little bit.
It does. And also, just I'm older and I went through a bad spell of, you know, rickety mental health. And now I value calmness and work-life balance, if people will forgive me for using that phrase. You know, but I'd rather, you know, go and pick my nephew up from school or go over and see my mother. You know, and in a way, I tell myself that those things are material.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm just really lucky in that I'm allowed to take the time that I need and that people will still read the book at the end.
Okay, favourite book ever?
Favourite book ever? Behind the Scenes at the Museum by Kate Atkinson.
Boom, there you go. She's been asked that question before. All right. Thank you for being
here.
Thank
you, Chris.
Can you
Thank
come
you
back
so
and see us again?
I would be delighted anytime. Thank you.
You are a superstar.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky on Virgin Radio.
Next time you think you've had a tough day at work, spare a thought for our next guest. He's a paediatric neurosurgeon that makes life-changing decisions for babies and children. His book, Everything That Makes Us Human, is out tomorrow and here to tell us his extraordinary story
stories is the equally extraordinary. Jay Jeyamohan.
Good morning, Jay.
Good morning.
How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Okay, it's great to have you here. Thank you for your book. Thank you for everything you do for the rest of the human race. When did it all be? How did it all begin?
It all began with me deciding that being a doctor was exciting, but actually being a neurosurgeon would be the icing on the cake as a very junior trainee.
And as far as surgery is concerned, and consultancy is concerned, with respect to all your colleagues around the world, is neuroscience, neurosurgery, being a brain surgeon, is that like the rock stardom of the operating theatre?
Well, I think I'm probably going to get beaten up by a lot of people when I go back. But of course it is. Of course it is. It's clearly the best thing ever to do. Why would you not want to look after people with these conditions, get them better? And if you can't get them better, make sure that they have as good a quality of life as they can.
How come it's so highly revered? Is it because the brain, you know, it's so fiddly, it's so fragile, it's so important to us, it's so powerful? You know, is brain surgery actually more difficult than other kinds of surgery? I have no idea.
I think operation-wise, it probably isn't, that there are lots of other things that are technically probably even more challenging. It's about the combination of working out what's wrong with the patient. When you do the operation, accepting that you may need to actually make them worse and give them new problems in order to try and help them from their condition, and understanding how that's going to affect each patient. So making someone's hands not work properly could be much more difficult for a pianist than for somebody who doesn't do a lot of fine finger work. So it's knowing your patient and intricately deciding how your treatment is going to affect every different patient differently.
Now, I presume you have, but I don't know for certain. Have you seen the story in the papers today with the lady playing the violin?
Yes, that was done by one of my ex-mates. We used to be junior doctors together.
Okay, so not an ex-mate, just ex-colleague.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Yeah, ex-colleague, yeah, okay. Correct.
So tell us the story as you read it today, as you heard about it today, this particular story.
That they did an operation where this lady needed an operation that could affect her ability to play the violin.
She's a virtuoso violinist.
Correct. So when you're in those really intricate areas, just a slight change of your angle or your approach to any area that you want to operate, let's say a tumour, then it can affect a completely different part of the brain that does something very different. And for someone like a violinist, their coordination and their balance of their fingers, things that we wouldn't even probably even notice, will make a huge difference to how they play their notes. Yeah. So when you're in such a close area, there's no point going, this is what this does, it moves the fingers. You actually want to see what it does to the potential for that patient. And the cleverest way that Kumar's managed to do it was by asking the lady to play the violin during the operation.
It's fascinating, it's intriguing. Is it useful as a message?
Yes, because it is, you know, it's a very trendy thing to talk about personalization of medicine nowadays. But actually, that's what neurosurgeons have been doing for so many years. Is about, we could get 100% of the tumor out, but it's going to give you these problems. Right. And some patients go, yeah, absolutely, I want to have as long a life as I can, even with disabilities. But other patients go, no, that's not a compromise I'm prepared to take. I'll take a shorter lifespan, able to do the thing that actually makes me want to get up every morning.
And that is a recurring theme through the book, isn't it? It's quality, it's quantity, you know, which is best. And sometimes it's a bit of both, isn't it, for a while?
Yes. Yeah, it can be very hard, especially now doing paediatrics, for people to maybe understand that sometimes we're striving to give kids just a few more years. But if you think what a kid can cram into 5 or 6 years of their life, and how we as adults, we just waste 5 or 6 years of our lives essentially doing nothing.
Yeah, presuming we have it to waste.
Correct, yeah. And when you've really got it in there, and for some of my kids who have knowingly had a shortened lifespan, they and their families have really had a ball.
Yeah. If you want to get into flow, you have to listen to music, is what you say.
Correct. Ever since I was I was 8 or 9, about that, and I had one of those, it was a Pi. Remember Pi?
Yeah, Pi.
Yeah, it was a Pi tape deck that my uncle gave me. For the younger listeners, you'll have to go and Google what a tape deck is.
It's like an iPod or something like that nowadays.
Yes. And I used to listen to music then, and I realised that I could study and learn much better when I had Talking Heads or Iron Maiden or later on sort of more dance music just playing. It allowed me to fade everything else out.
Isn't that interesting? That's so interesting because, you know, you say you use different music depending on different operations, moods, different teams you're with. So whenever would techno beat Led Zeppelin? Just take me through that if you don't mind.
Yeah. So I mean, we could that will end up with being a fight between lots of different audiences. But techno, it's the repetitive beat. The thing that a lot of people hate about techno is right. What those of us who love it. It's that repetitive beat that allows you to almost get hypnotized by right. it. The same way that you can dance to it for 6 hours.
Right.
You can operate to it for 6 hours or even read a book for 6 hours and study.
This is the thing, isn't it? Because people may or may not realize how long these operations take. So a typical tumor, there isn't a typical tumor extraction, is there? I wouldn't imagine.
There is a certain location at the back of the head that lots of kids get tumors there. Right. And those operations will take between 4 and 8 hours in total to do. And you need to be focused essentially throughout that time period.
And what about, what's a really long procedure that you've been part of?
The longest one was when I was a junior and it was 28 hours.
28 hours. And yeah. every the same team sticks around?
No, the nursing staff switched through.
Right.
I was a trainee and my boss and I did it on Christmas Eve in Glasgow together.
And how come it was so long?
It was an abnormal collection of blood vessels that had bled. And once you get into that, you have to get it out because it will just carry on bleeding while you're doing the operation.
Right.
So you make a decision. And once you go boots in, You've got to do it all. You can't stop because it will just carry on bleeding.
Jay, thank you. It's a real pleasure to meet you.
Thank you very much.
Well
indeed.
Done, pal.
Thank you.
The book is Everything That Makes Us Human, Case Notes of a Children's Brain Surgeon.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky on Virgin Radio.
Thank you so much for listening to this, the podcast of the Virgin Radio Breakfast Show. Don't forget you can subscribe and get it every week from wherever you get your podcast, and you will never miss the weekly roundup of all the best bits from our Virgin Radio Breakfast Show with Sky.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.